This is Business Impact, a podcast series from UCD College of Business, Ireland's leading business school. I'm your host, Emmett Oliver, and each episode I'll be joined by world-renowned faculty from across the College of Business, as well as international industry leaders who'll offer us insight, spark curiosity, and challenge you to rethink how you do business in a changing world. Now, you're welcome back to another edition of Business Impact, UCD Business School's podcast, as we rattle towards Christmas somewhat nervously. Lots of weird chimes and songs in the shops. It's already happening, folks, and we'll be there very, very soon. And we're sort of getting some of our best material for you at this stage towards this final fourth quarter. And we have a great conversation, which I'm really looking forward to today, from a UCD BCom graduate, soon to get an award. We just mentioned that briefly. And she has been head of one of Ireland's most well-known companies in the food business for quite a few years. And that, of course, is Glanbia, which a lot of people will know. They may have had shares in the company. They may have been suppliers to the company. They may, of course, have been customers to the company as well. And for the last really well over a decade of time, Siobhan Talbot has been the chief executive, and she's recently wrapped up in the last year or two. And now she is a non-executive director at various places, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. She was, as I said, a graduate of UCD in the mid-1980s and also did a diploma in accounting after she did her BCom. So we're really delighted to have her on our conversation in Business Impact today. Siobhan, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Emma. Delighted to be with you.
Fantastic. Listen, let's start at a good place, which is the beginning. It's always good. Let's talk about your first few years in UCD back in the 1980s doing a Bachelor of Commerce. It's a while ago, but nevertheless, it's a very influential course. A lot of people have used it as a springboard for their career. You're among that group. Tell us about your time in UCD and what you studied and what you enjoyed.
Yeah, no, it was hugely influential, I would say, Emmett, to the later career that I had the pleasure of actually having for so many decades. And my story with UCD is interesting, and I guess probably started actually back in my secondary education. I had a great commerce teacher, and I always liked numbers. And I had this desire then maybe to go to UCD. When I started, actually, in truth, I was thinking of being a teacher. My mother was a teacher. Okay. And so I started and I thought, oh, maybe I'll do teaching. And I think it was possibly a somewhat random conversation with a tutor while I was in UCD, and they mentioned accountancy. And I would say, you know, back in, I was in UCD from 81 to 84 and then did the diploma in 85. And it's possibly hard for a lot of people that will be listening to this to just imagine how different Ireland of the 80s was to Ireland of 2025. So UCD, coming from South Kilkenny, was a big eye-opener for me. In fact, amusingly, when I started, I didn't even know where UCD was, which sounds really crazy. My very first morning, I was with my sister. We were renting a house in Sandymount. We were with others. And I got the bus to town, got the bus out, landed, I think, in Donnybrook, thinking, I'm sure they should be here by now. And got off the bus and eventually made my way up to UCD. I think our first lecture was from John Teeling, which was always
okay.
Yeah, really interesting. And so UCD, I think, just really opened my eyes as a young one to what opportunities could come my way, meeting different people, just that great environment of education and a bit of fun and all those things you enjoy at those tender young years. So it was great. I will have always very fond memories there.
And Siobhan, of all the different subjects you did, you've already mentioned the accounting and the numbers, but obviously you do other things in there. You do marketing, you do human resources, you do finance. There's all sorts of stuff stacked up. What was it, the accounting that came out strongly, or were you as interested in all the others as well?
Yeah, it probably was. And I would say, actually, what was interesting, and I was just remembering it when I was thinking about this recently, there was a personnel side to it as well that I actually liked. The culture, personnel management, and the people side that I actually enjoyed. But the accounting, no doubt, was the core. Accounting and economics, I really liked that. And it is funny to remember, too, you know, there was obviously technology, but it was so early stage, the massive big machines that were around at the time, doing probably a fraction of what we can now do on our iPhone. But it was marvellous. It was such a marvellous, marvellous degree.
Nowadays, and I just want to see if there is that contrast, a lot of students and a lot want to get into the big four. There's milk rounds, there's big internships, there's application processes that seem to go on forever. So there's a lot of that activity around getting into one of those four companies. Was that the same in your time, or is that not quite as to the fore? What was just going to give us an idea of what people were trying to do when they wrapped up in their final year?
Yeah, 100%, Emmett, it was the same. And I was probably fortuitous in that conversation with the tutor. I think probably happened maybe early in second year, because my memory would be that the milk round was in second year, going into your third year. And yes, it was absolutely competitive. All the firms would be around. But interestingly, in some ways, it created an enthusiasm for the profession, because you had all this activity going on around who was doing interviews where, who was getting appointed where, et cetera, et cetera. And so at that point in time, I was kind of saying, yeah, you know, I think this I could really like. And it was interesting because then obviously I met with PwC. And at the time, then PwC sponsored me for the Diploma in Professional Accounting, which I did in 85. But PwC took on 40 that year from graduate in UCD, and there were 20 girls and 20 guys, and that was seen as so progressive, which it was in the 80s. Yeah.
And listen, in terms of the work then in PwC, how did you find that? You're going in there pretty young, you're just out of college, you know, it's a big company internationally and so on. We all know it can be a tough first few years for people who go in there on that wave of intake. So how did you find it?
No question. I found it a great experience, no question. But they do work you hard. Oh my God, long hours, out on audits. But you know, it tells you the school of hard graft as well, which is no bad thing at that age. You learn all sorts of soft skills. You know, you're going out to a client, you mightn't be the first person they wanted to see of a morning, but you learn how to get the job done. You learn about teams, you learn about managing up, sideways, you know, developing your own career. I had the opportunity then to do some of the tutoring for the new graduates that would come in the following year. I really liked that. And you just get this marvelous experience across a diversity of businesses. You're at a young age, you have a camaraderie with a whole lot of young folk. We used to have great fun. In fact, I would say that camaraderie element is a huge part of the whole experience, because the work is hard, but you just are with this body of young people, all enthusiastic for achieving the qualification, all working hard, all kind of pretty focused on what they want to do at that point in time. And remember, of course, that in the we joke sometimes, you know, but in current years, like at that point in time, we probably would have paid PwC to take us on, because getting a job was such a big deal.
Yeah, I think people don't realise just the crippling unemployment of the mid-80s. We're talking, you know, 15, 20%, that sort of range. I mean, a lot of people just heading to the planes and boats to Britain or the US or wherever they could go. So that's sometimes forgotten. You were in that environment. It probably affected, I suppose, even what you were doing, and there was probably a big emphasis on just getting into any job, was there, I'm presuming?
No question, Emmett, there was. I mean, clearly there's lots of things we need to manage in the country right now, but it's hard for those maybe who weren't around to comprehend what Ireland of the 80s was versus Ireland of now. Just the opportunities weren't there. Lots of people had to leave. The dole queues were enormous. So getting a good job was massive. And when you had it, then you really wanted to work to keep it. So I think it ingrained a sense of hard work, commitment that would get you there. And then, you know, I had an opportunity then to travel with PwC, which was superb.
Now, you're talking about the accountancy profession at the time, auditing, that sort of area. I would have presumed it was very male dominated, but you're saying the numbers coming out of the university were a little bit more balanced. But in its practices and in its traditions, was it still quite male dominated, maybe even in its thinking in the mid 80s, or was it starting to change even then?
I would say it was still quite male-dominated, in fairness. I would say PwC were particularly progressive. It was seen as progressive at the time. So it was quite male-dominated in the upper echelons. But I have to say, and through all my career, that was never an issue, really, never a substantive issue. It just was what it was, quite frankly, and you accepted that to be what it was, but it didn't actually impact development of my own career. And I guess I just... kind of always think at the end of the day, if you love what you're doing, you put the hard work in, you'll get through whatever it is. And I was particularly fortunate about the mentors I had along the way in PwC and in my later career. They were always hugely supportive of what I wanted to achieve.
Well, actually, we do share one thing. One of my first ever journalistic assignments when I was in the Irish Times at the time was to do the merger between Waterford Foods and Avonmore, or Waterford Co-op and Avonmore Co-op. And for a Dubliner, this wasn't an easy assignment because I didn't know virtually anything about co-ops or the food industry at the time. But I was put outside the actual voting AGM where you were all deciding on the merger. So I'm not sure I was able to bring much to the party journalistically at that time. But you joined Waterford Foods in the early 90s. Obviously, you had the Kilkenny background. Was there anything beyond that, like being from the area, that brought you to that company? Or had you been doing some audit work with the PwC before? Or what was the connection?
Yeah, well, the connection really was the Southeast. So Billy and I had met when we were quite young. Billy's my husband. We had the opportunity to go to Australia with PwC, which we did in the late 80s. And then we came back in 90 actually. And then I rejoined PwC. And we always had a hankering. We're both from the Southeast. And Billy's a retired guard now, and we both had a hankering to come down south. He was a guard in Dublin at the time. He applied to come down the southeast, and then of course in the natural spirit of life he came through quicker than we thought. So we had this kind of oh my god moment. He's just been transferred down to the southeast. What happens now? So I was looking for roles around the southeast, and PwC were very good at the time. They had some contacts down in Waterford, so I joined Waterford Foods in July of 92. It's fair to say that that was really interesting. That was quite a culture shock from PwC, but...
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, I remember the company, all right. Like, I mean, it was very agrarian, the company, like, in terms of, yes. Like, it was real farmer-led, you know. Would that be fair?
100%. It was... Art was marvellous, you know, it was... And I know, possibly being from the southeast, my father, we'd lost him when I was quite young, but he was a dairy farmer, he had been a dairy farmer, and just knowing, I guess, rural Ireland helped, but it was a baptism of fire. But a superb learning experience. And the merger that you reference, I joined in 92. I had a great boss there, he was the finance director. The merger came in 97. That was just huge. I was in finance then. I had the opportunity to go to farmer meetings, selling the merger. It was a baptism of fire. But I'll tell you, a baptism too in, you know, how to execute a strategic direction. It was marvellous.
Yeah, what people might not realise was Ireland used to have a lot more co-ops, just the sheer number of them stretched across the country. There's obviously a lot less, and there's been a huge consolidation, and some of them are no longer even co-ops. And we can talk about that in a second. But I suppose that's the world you were coming from at that point. There was co-ops pretty much in every town almost.
Yeah, a lot of the consolidation had already happened. It's interesting, when I joined Waterford Foods in 92, if you asked anybody in Ireland what are the most innovative sectors, I'm not sure that anybody would have said agriculture and dairy. But the reality is, it was hugely innovative. And I would forever take my hat off to all the predecessors of the cooperative movement, because what you had in Ireland, starting obviously with Horace Plunkett in the late 1800s, is farmers coming together to effectively, at its most basic, get a better market for their produce. So you had a whole lot of small co-ops all over the country in the 60s and 70s. They amalgamated, probably 50 companies ultimately amalgamated to form what is Avonmore and Waterford. And then, of course, we joined Europe in the 70s. That was huge for agriculture. But then, of course, we had quotas coming in 85. And that changed the landscape completely, because then you had a ceiling on what farmers could produce in Ireland. So in that spirit of innovation, all of the innovative farmers and cooperative folk at the time said, we have to go off the island of Ireland. So then a number, Kerry, Waterford, Avonmore, they went to the public markets, still majority owned by farmers, but the public markets in 88, and started this era of expansion outside the island of Ireland, because Ireland was volume constrained because of quotas from Europe.
Now, what I like about your career was you managed to get, and I don't say this pejoratively, but the straitjacket of just being a purebred accountant and auditor. I noticed that in 2000 you became a group secretary for the company, which brings you into a kind of a wider area of the board and corporate governance and all sorts of other stuff. Was that a big moment for you, just to sort of have all the accountancy stuff, but just sort of slightly sidestepping into a few other areas? Did that sort of broaden things out for you?
Yeah, it did. I'd always been very fortunate from my beginning days in the group because we had this somewhat idiosyncratic structure where we had the PLC and the co-op together. You always had the opportunity to span a whole lot of different areas. So I had done a lot in finance, but I'd always been interested too in the strategic and the legal side. And the legal side, obviously, is that whole area of the company secretaries. And the secretariat side of Glanbia was always significantly involved in the co-op and its structures and its rules and all that element of it. And so I did that in 2000, and then I became deputy. But finance was still at the core. Even while I was doing that role, there was a lot of finance for the co-op involved as well, and touching the whole group. And then I became deputy finance director of the group, which included the co-op in 2005, finance director 2009, and then CEO in 2013.
Might be a good idea for both of us, Siobhan, for the listeners' benefit, to explain that the structure of Glanbia over the years, there's been a co-op part of a wider company. Maybe you could talk us through that.
Yes, it really interesting. And from a career perspective, really, really phenomenal, because we had this structure. So when the company went to the public markets in 88, the majority of shareholders, in fact, still were Irish farmers. And there was a period then of evolution of the group. But all of the assets were really owned by the PLC, and all the business activity was done by the PLC, although the co-op structure remained there. So over all the years, when I was finance director, when I was CEO, as my predecessors, you had this unusual circumstance where you were finance director and CEO of the public company, but also of your largest shareholder. You were finance director and CEO of the co-op as well. The co-op really only became an operating co-op when we started this journey of evolution. And that started in 2012, when the co-op actually bought some of the businesses in here in Ireland, and we did it in a joint venture. And so the organisation started to move that little bit apart, but the CEO, this executive team, was still combined until we ultimately divided into two separate organisations completely in 2021. So we'd had a joint venture together from 2012, but I was still, for example, at that point I was CEO of both in 2013. And then in 21, the two organisations completely split to what is now Tierlawn and Glanbia PLC. So on that journey, interestingly, you had this wonderful opportunity to, we were really driving the PLC, but you were also driving and minding and looking after the farmer stakeholder base as well. And it made for some really interesting times, I'll tell you.
Yes, I can imagine. Now, one of the big strategic changes, massive change really for you and for the company, was this idea of moving away from purely food production, you know, dare I say it, the milk and the bacon and the eggs and all that side of things, and moving into more nutrition and supplements and all of that, health. Like, where did that idea come from? Like, I mean, presumably, like, it was thought about for quite a while, but that was a radical thing to do. It would have been maybe in some ways easier just to stay where you were. So just talk me through that sort of chapter.
Yes, I suppose sometimes it's a necessity, the mother of invention. The merger was strategically terribly logical, hugely logical, but fractious a little within the farmer stakeholder base. And we had a tough few years immediately post the merger. So if you think of that now, you're in the early 2000s. And as an executive team, we coined this phrase, we had to earn the right to grow. At that point in time in our history, we had a lot of businesses in the UK. We had meat businesses, we had dairy businesses. It was really UK and Ireland, with tiny little footprint in North America. And John Maloney took over as CEO in 2000. And as an executive team, we said, look, we're going to have to really change what we're at here, because our market positions, frankly, weren't robust enough to really drive the group forward. And so we set about a period of transformation. We effectively exited the UK. We had significant dairy businesses, liquid milk, meat, exited all of those and set our sights to North America. And from relatively small beginnings in North America, which had started prior to that, we built up a very significant dairy position, starting in Wisconsin and in Idaho. And from that, then we entered nutrition. And it was really interesting. So while my own career, I had the good fortune for it to span over 30 years, I've often said to folk, Emmett, that it felt like I worked in three or four different organisations because there were very distinct phases. So that nutrition phase really was, began in those 2000s. We built a fantastic, and it's part of the group today, a fantastic primary cheese and whey business in North America. If you're having a McDonald's in North America, chances are it's from a Glanbia facility. And that brought us then further up the value chain on areas like whey processing when we bought the leading sports nutrition brand in Optimum Nutrition. And that's really been, so nutrition, both on the branded and ingredient side, has been the calling card for Glanbia PLC now since that kind of, I would say, 2008 to 2010-ish, 2010 forward.
And was there, obviously, there was, this was all road tested and you had a very well-designed business plan and all, and you had presumably strategic advisors and all this sort of stuff. But was there a little bit of nerves around, like, we don't know this nutrition stuff. We don't know about people going to gyms and taking supplements. It's not something in our bones, so to speak. So you had to obviously hire in a lot of expertise for the initial period. But was there any sense of kind of like, we're in uncharted waters here, folks. This could go wrong badly.
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. It really is a great question because it was interesting when we bought Optimum Nutrition. The reality is the market didn't really like it. Oh, it's a fad. You know, what are you doing? And we felt we completely had the license to move, because if you think about it, we had already taken a product which was a waste product from cheese making. You get a lot of whey, but our fabulous innovators and R&D folk had determined validly that there's fabulous nutrition, branched chain amino acids, high quality protein in that product that had been land spread or fed to pigs. And so we started in the US where we were effectively concentrating that down into a high quality protein. And the US was perfect because you needed scale to justify the investment. And so we were an ingredient supplier of this product, this powder, high quality, high protein powder, to what was an emerging industry in North America of sports nutrition. And there was one particular customer we had at the time. They were Costello Brothers, and they decided they were doing terribly well, but then they decided to move on. And we said, we bought the business. And that was Optimum Nutrition. And then we bought a number of business, we did a lot of businesses after that. So we actually thought, you know, we know brands, that's not that different. We had had Avonmore for decades here in Ireland. We had moved, so we'd had the ingredient consumer lens in Ireland, and we felt that they could coexist very well. And so we felt that this wasn't as much outside our wheelhouse. But when we went to the market with it, I think they were kind of thinking, what are they at? Why don't they just double down more on ingredients? And, you know, sometimes you get a bit of good fortune as well. But that has just been, and a super team. I mean, you know, Hugh that's now running Glanbia ran GPN from the very beginning. And yeah, it's just been a great story. Logical to our minds, but you know, then you're in the process, as you rightly say, of bringing people with you on that logic.
Yeah, I suppose it's always, everyone's always happy after the decision, but I'm sure there was a certain amount of nerves at this front end. In terms of being the CEO, Siobhan, you went in there in, I believe, 2013, am I correct?
That's right.
Yeah, and you were still, like, for the average CEO, you had a good longevity, which not everyone has in that particular job these days, at least. The shelf life can be short. Tell our listeners a little bit about being the CEO of a publicly listed company, publicly quoted company in this day and age. I mean, yes, people are well remunerated and, you know, you're up there in lights and you're the leader of the company setting the strategy and all the rest of it. But it must also be quite a stressy kind of a job with all the reporting cycles and the endless pressure to financially perform and all the rest. So just talk to me a little bit about just the reality of the job.
Yeah, there's no doubt that it is tough. You know, it is. I was fortunate in that I loved it. I just loved it. I always loved the culture, the ambition. I think our very roots in Glanbia, Emmett, were such that, you know, we were very grounded all the time. I mean, and maybe that history of, you know, talking strategy to stakeholders in London or New York one day and going down to a regional meeting in Waterford another day to explain how it was all coming together kept us very grounded. There is no doubt, though, I saw over my tenure even, the pace of change now is absolutely relentless. That is always going to keep pressure on the system. So it is tough. And the markets, the other thing I would say I learned over my tenure, the markets have become very short term. You know, when I started even as CEO, you were having conversations with shareholders, and our co-op was always one who I think would have that wonderful perspective of being true long term, where they could see the strategy and how it might operate under different periods of the economic cycle. The reality now is a lot of capital markets are very short term. So that, to your point, does increase pressure on quarterlies, et cetera, et cetera. But you know what? At the end of the day, what I would also say is that that does drive performance. I mean, you get a team, as we had in Glanbia, that are hugely ambitious, and you know that you have to merge the long and the short term. So I think you put your emphasis and your work and all of the team aligned on watching all the time what might be around the next corner while executing in the near term as well. And frankly, you just know that that is the game you're in. You're in it because you love it. There's a whole lot of stakeholders that are dependent on you, from your suppliers to your customers to your employees to your shareholders. And you get a great buzz out of it. There's no doubt. It's a great... And I used to speak with the team. You know, I always coined there's what I used to call good busy, when it's just buzzing and not everything is going as you might hope, but you'll always be things you're managing, but the fundamentals are driving on. Bad busy is when things are just really tough, and that's just tough.
I don't want too much bad busy. I don't like the sound of bad busy. Can I ask you a question as well, the counterfactual question? If you hadn't made the move into the nutritional side and all of that and had just stayed a conventional co-op, you know, type business or food production business, because we hear every day that it's a low margin business, it's absolutely cutthroat, it's gone so global now, it's very hard for food producers in the Western part of the world to compete with more low cost operators in other parts of the world. So this is what we hear. So if you guys hadn't made that shift, could it have been quite a painful outcome if you hadn't taken that fateful decision to shift the strategy?
Yeah, look, I think there's a lot of co-ops still, both globally and even here in Ireland, they're good businesses, but we would not have had the value creation for the farmers, for example, that have been part of the Glanbia structure. I think, idiosyncratic though it might have been, I think what we were able to do through the strategic direction that we chose collectively, and it was collective with that farmer grouping, we were able to create a lot of value. And we were ultimately able to create value in way, because we give a lot of spin-outs of value directly to farmers. So that's where the shares would go directly to them. So we were able to spin out a lot of value while ultimately creating two very large businesses. Tirlán is a fantastic global player in purer dairy, for the want of a better phrase, that can support the ambition and the growth ambition of Irish farmers. It is still a very significant shareholder, I think about 18-19% shareholder now in Glanbia PLC, which is very much that global nutrition player. So as a model, I think it actually really worked. And I think those two organisations are going to go on with now a very clear focus on their relative shareholder base to bigger and better things. And over my tenure, Emmet, it was always really interesting because I would speak with a lot of players across the dairy sector in New Zealand, in Europe, in the US. And they were always really interested in our structure because it was that little bit unusual. And I actually think that if you go back over the total history, I actually think it creates a lot of value, and I think it's only beginning, actually, because the two organisations are so strong now in terms of where they can take it forward.
Yeah, and you've obviously been so successful, all of you. I mean, the food businesses collectively in exporting Irish goods, you know, food products of various types abroad. I mean, I even see Dawn Meats doing deals down in New Zealand now, which is a long way away, right? So I mean, do you think that's going to continue, that sort of globalization of Irish food generally?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's essential. Again, if I go back to the very genesis of the movement here in Ireland, you can only laud the foresight of the predecessors prior to me and my predecessors, who saw that we have this great natural ability here to produce great food. We produce far more than we can consume. It's a relatively small domestic consumer market here. So they had to create markets overseas. So they were talking about creating global markets before anybody else was thinking of it, in truth. So, you know, whether it is Tirlán or any of the other Irish-based organisations, most of their output will go overseas. And it is very, Ireland is very similar to New Zealand, actually, in that instance, because both countries produce a lot more than they locally consume, and both then go forward onto the global market. So they have been global businesses before anybody really used the word global businesses.
Now, the one sort of cloud possibly hanging over the industry, and maybe I'm misreading this, but we're very much heavy involved in sort of, non-arable farming. You know, we're not into cereals as much. We're very much, as you said, we're into the milk, we're into the meats and so on. Are we vulnerable in the world of climate change and less meat eating and so on, that the Irish product is not in the faster growing areas? Or is that something that would concern you, that we need to reshape what we're doing here? And I know it's, I know a lot of farmers will be throwing stuff at this podcast if they're listening at all in the first place. But is there something there that we have a concern about, that we're just not maybe as set up as we should be for the future of food in the next 50 or 100 years?
I think we are well set up, in truth, but it's going to be a continuing change journey. The reality is, the question of sustainability has been part of, again, the agenda of the industry before it was even talked of on a general scale. Because the reality is, as stakeholders for their farms here in Ireland, the good farmers, frankly, always recognise that if you have a good business, all aspects of your business have to work well. That is good farming, and good husbandry of your herd. It's all just part of their DNA. And it was really interesting over my tenure, and we see these, we had a great lens in Glanbia because we could see how dairy operations, we're a very large scale operator in the US, and in the US our joint venture partner is the largest co-op in North America, and we could see how it's done over there, and we could see how it's done here in Ireland. And Ireland does have this grass-fed sustainable story which continues and will continue to play very well globally. We cannot be complacent. There, of course, is an agenda that Irish farmers are travelling with the support of their co-ops, whether it is Dairy Gold or Tyrlán or Kerry. They'll continue to travel that journey of sustainability, and they know they have to do that, and they will continue to do that. And there are a lot of technology developments that are happening right across all the elements, whether it is feed, whether it is the husbandry, whether it is the final product, as to ways you can make this work. I think if you think about how the globe is evolving and the impact of climate change, and you think of the regions where food can be produced versus the regions where increasingly producing food will be more difficult, Ireland is very well positioned. Can never be complacent. The industry needs to continue to be progressive and ambitious, but it has always been. So I think it'll continue.
Yeah, well. And I think, we see the slogan about the changes, but equally you see the demand for meat products is globally, that is absolutely huge, and you can see, of course, the prices reflecting that. So we have to, I suppose, it's kind of a differentiate out between the long term and the short term and all that. Listen, I want to, because time is up against us very severely, you're now in a new phase of your life and your career. I know you're a non-executive director. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing now and what the future may hold for Siobhan Talbot.
Well, I promised myself when I retired, having worked full time for nearly 40 years, that I would take a good break, which I did. I promised Billy and Thomas and Alice, our two young folk, we're not that young anymore. But so I did. I promised myself 12 to 24 months, which I'm pretty coming to the end of now. I had the good fortune, I was on the CRH board before I retired from Glanbia, and I've continued on that. It's just a superb organisation. So I've taken a good break, and I'll see. I have really enjoyed the change of pace. A little bit to your earlier question, it was a huge privilege for me to be CEO of the great team that we had in Glanbia over such a long period of time. But interestingly, it's only when you stop you realise how full on it was, and it was pretty full on. So I've really enjoyed that. I'm an avid gardener. I love my garden here in South Kilkenny. So I have loved that change of pace. So I'll see. I'm not in any mad rush. It won't be full time for sure, because I loved what I did, but I really wanted to have a change of pace.
Honestly, you won't set up a podcast.
You're fine, Emma. No, you're very safe.
You could cause us some competitive problems, I think, because you talk very fluently and very well and very lively. So, and we've had a lot of CEOs on this podcast, so we can make that judgment. So, listen, it's been a great conversation. Well done on a fantastic career. I know that's going to be recognised at the time of recording. I'll just leave it like that. and well deserved, making that UCD, cementing that UCD connection which you've had for such a long time. As I said, you've emerged out of the CEO's chair intact, you know, and not everyone does that. So you seem to be in good mood and good fortune. So thank you very much for joining us, and the conversation today was really enjoyable.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Now, if you enjoyed this week's episode of the UCD Business Impact Podcast, please subscribe to episodes on Apple Podcast or Spotify. We cover a broad range of topics with insights from business leaders around the world, so there's sure to be something there for everyone. I'd like to thank our production team of Beth Gormley and Mike Liffey. They work tirelessly in the background, sourcing interviewees, editing, promoting episodes, and everything in between. I've been your host, Emmett Oliver, and we hope you can join us next time on UCD Business Impact.